This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Attorney Flint Taylor on the lessons of the Greensboro Massacre.
You got to put a wooden stake through the heart of the Nazis and the Klan. They just don't go away.
As part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we'll talk with Attorney Ann O'Berry.
Ann left a lucrative job in New York City to pursue death penalty work in the South. Today we'll hear from Ann about that work and her continuing efforts to protect civil liberties in Florida and throughout the South.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. As an added feature on Law and Disorder, Michael Smith and I will occasionally be doing op-eds or editorials. And Michael, I understand you have one?
Yes, I do. Are you ready for it?
Ready.
There's a gun massacre of at least four people every other day in this country. Some 60,000 people have been killed by guns this year alone. We just don't hear about it unless it's spectacular, like the last church mass murders or the Las Vegas ones 2 weeks before. The politicians, mostly bought off by the gun lobby, offer thoughts and prayers. They lower the flag to half-mast and move on. Some even give advice that people should bring guns to church. In Texas, an open carry state, students are allowed to bring guns to class. Imagine teaching in a situation like that, or preaching, for that matter. The American people are educated, falsely, that the Second Amendment ensures that everyone can own guns, even machine guns, like the automatic rifles that were used in the last two massacres. Like people need an automatic rifle to go squirrel hunting. People around the world think Americans are crazy to allow this. There are 1,000 police killings so far this year. In Scotland, there were none. Why? Because in Scotland, police do not carry guns. And in Scotland, people don't use automatic rifles to go grouse hunting. My advice? Either change the laws and change your minds, or move to Scotland. Heidi, do you have one for us?
I do, and I've titled mine, Schoogalification. Elementary and secondary schools should not be marketplaces for big business to groom young consumers. But in the last 5 years, schools are becoming just that. Profit and marketing centers. And it's time for parents and educators to come to their senses. The technology colossus Google is providing low-cost Chrome laptops to schools across the nation, along with free apps for students and teachers. In total, more than half of the country's primary and secondary school students, and that's over 30 million children, use Google Education apps, including Gmail and Docs. The very affordable Google laptops comprise more than half of all mobile devices sent to schools. Google has crafted a new sales technique to place their products in the classroom. It's wholly inappropriate. It enlists educators and school administrators to promote Google laptops and apps to other schools, effectively turning those we entrust with our children's education into salespersons. That's a predatory practice that amounts to trafficking precious human resources, our data. And it's all the more insidious because teachers are expected to provide a moral compass, not a ticket to commercial servitude. Google profits from this more than we know, quite literally. Their practices are opaque. Their profits don't come from the actual devices, but rather from turning students, children, into loyal customers and likely for life. In turn, Google reaps one of the hottest commodities on the market now, our own personal data. With this data, birth dates, email addresses, our likes, our dislikes, Google and many other companies that it allows access to the data or to whom it sells the data, advertisers are custom tailoring increasingly sophisticated and insidious marketing gimmicks that pervade every waking minute of our lives, from the moment we turn on a computer or a tech device until we turn it off at night. When students move their school files and emails to a personal Google account, they fall prey to Google's privacy policies. Their goal of Google is to hook kids at an early age under the well-known premise that if you earn their loyalty early on, they'll be a happy follower for their entire lives. After Google began pitching to schools a few years ago, they brought a motivational message. Google's salespersons told teachers that their devices would actually improve students' college and career prospects with their online tools. Google brazenly bypassed school administrators and went straight to teachers touting low-cost and easy-to-use services. The tech giant even set up online communities called Google Educator Groups, where teachers can exchange ideas for using their technology. Because there is no transparency in what personal information Google collects from children and how it's used, school administrators and the public will never know what it's used for or how it might hurt a child in the future. Google refuses to provide the details of what it aggregates, stores, and shares with marketers. We also know that targeted advertisements and social media messages have assumed too much leverage in our society, dissuading people from thinking for themselves. In children, it's far worse because they go to school to learn critical thinking. Educators and parents need to wake up before Google takes over the entire American educational landscape. We don't need more consumers. We do need more thinkers and doers. And Michael, I'd like to thank reporter Natasha Singer from the New York Times for an in-depth article she did on this topic in May, on May 13th. It was called How Google Took Over the Classroom.
Thanks, Heidi. That was excellent.
On November 3, 1979, 35 heavily armed members of the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party drove 9 vehicles through the city of Greensboro, North Carolina, and opened fire on a multiracial group of demonstrators who were gathering at a black housing project in preparation for an anti-Klan march. Using semi-automatic rifles, shotguns, and pistols, the Nazis and Ku Kluxers fired 1,000 projectiles in 88 seconds, killing 5 march leaders and wounding 7 other demonstrators. Most of the victims were associated with the Communist Workers' Party, a multiracial group that had been organizing in the South for workers' rights in the cotton mills and against the KKK. The Greensboro Police, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the FBI were all aware of the planned attack. 4 television stations captured the massacre on video. A reluctant local district attorney obtained 6 indictments under pressure from the Greensboro Justice Fund that had been organized by the widows of the victims and public outcry. A 6-month trial resulted in the acquittal of all 6 defendants. Then, a reluctant Reagan administration, Department of Justice, tried 9 of the Klansmen and Nazis on civil rights conspiracy charges. After a 3-month trial, all 9 were acquitted. A year after the massacre, a civil rights lawsuit was brought on behalf of the 16 victims. It exposed the depth and the contours of official involvement. After an extraordinary, dramatic 10-week civil trial, a Southern jury finally convicted a good number of the actors in the massacre. The verdict was national news. Here to speak with us today is Flint Taylor, one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs in the Greensboro civil case. Flint is a founding member of the People's Law Office in Chicago and has been counsel in numerous civil rights cases over the past 48 years, including the Fred Hampton assassination case and the John Birch torture cases.
Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be back, Michael.
Flint, there were 2 acquittals on the criminal cases in the Greensboro massacre. How do you explain that?
Well, I think you can explain it with 2 or 3 reasons. One is that they were all white juries. Secondly, the juries, of course, were imbued by the defense in anti-communism, because the plaintiffs or the victims were avowed communists, and also they were multiracial. So there was the racism that was engendered by the case. So in those cases, the prosecutors did not really have the devotion to winning the cases. So all of that added into the fact that they were acquittals in cases where the murders were on videotape.
Well, you then brought a third action on the civil side of the court, and I'm interested from a technical aspect, what was the legal basis for the civil suit that you brought against these murderers?
Well, the lawyer who really was the first person to bring it, along in conjunction with the Wonderful Widows and the Greensboro Justice Fund, was Lewis Pitts, who is a terrific movement lawyer from North Carolina, actually originally from South Carolina, and he asked me to get involved about a year into the case because of our experience in the Fred Hampton police assassination of the two Black Panther leaders here in Chicago. The basis of the lawsuit was under the Anti-Klan Act of 1871 that was modernized into Section 42 U.S.C. 1983, which in 1985, which permits a private individual who their constitutional rights have been violated, and particularly their right to equal protection of law, to bring a civil suit for damages against the police officials who are acting under color of law, and Klansmen and Nazis who, for example, are acting with racial animus. So that is the provision of the Civil Rights Act that we were able to pursue the civil lawsuit.
Talk about law enforcement involvement in the massacre, please.
Well, if you go all the way back in history to when law enforcement first became involved in the South, because that's around slavery time, and you look as you go forward, you see that sheriffs and police departments, as they developed, and the FBI as they came into existence in the early 1900s, often facilitated and participated in racial violence and lynchings and beatings and murders. And during the civil rights movement in the 60s, we saw that again and again, where the FBI would know about the Klan or Nazi going to attack civil rights workers and not show up. And the old line was that they'd give them 15 minutes to do what they were going to do before they would show up. And often we now know that the Klan and Nazi parties were permeated with informants and provocateurs that were working for the FBI but actually became leaders in the Klan. And I think the statistics were, at one point in the 60s, a quarter of the Klan were actually FBI-related informants. So in the Greensboro case, now we're dealing in 1979, and we're supposedly dealing with the New South and a city in the New South. Yet what happened in the Greensboro case was that the Klan and Nazis came riding into Greensboro, armed to the teeth, with murder on their minds, and went to where an anti-Klan march was going to begin and opened fire on them. And turned out that the leader of that caravan of cars, Klan and Nazi cars, was not only a police informant, but was formerly an FBI informant. And it also turned out that one of the main Nazi people involved in planning this murderous caravan was a alcohol, firearms, and tax undercover agent. So not only were the police and the FBI and the other federal agencies aware that this was going to happen, but they had informants and agents provocateur who were in leadership of the actual caravan that drove into Greensboro and that resulted in the murders of five anti-Klan demonstrators and the injury of many more.
Well, Attorney Flint Taylor, you were part of the team that brought the civil rights lawsuit. What were some of the dramatic moments in the trial?
Well, the trial was dramatic in many ways. It was conducted by Judge Robert Marriage, who was a federal judge that was brought down from Richmond, Virginia. And Marriage had a reputation as being a liberal Kennedy appointment, John F. Kennedy appointment. He had been instrumental in the desegregation of the schools in Richmond in the early 70s. And he was sent down there to clean up in some way the legal atrocities, which were that these men were acquitted both of murder in the state courts and of civil rights violations in the federal courts. So Judge Marriage ran a very tight ship, and the trial started in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in March of 1985. And our case, unlike the criminal cases, had broad-ranging conspiracy allegations connecting not only the Klan and Nazis, but also the police informants, and the FBI and the Bureau of Firearms and Alcohol. And in the trial, we, the legal team, attempted to contrast in many instances these Nazis and Klansmen who boasted of their racism and boasted about how they were going to maim and murder and actually did on TV video. The police weren't there, but TV stations were there to cover the demonstration in March, so it was all on video. So this was back when technology wasn't quite the same as it is now, but we had seven monitors in the courtroom, and we would repeatedly show the videos of the various defendants, Nazis and Klansmen, jumping out of their cars and shooting down clients. That was quite dramatic when those videos were shown. It was also quite dramatic when the plaintiffs, the surviving plaintiffs, testified. And there was one particularly dramatic scenario that I was involved in as one of the three main trial lawyers, along with Lewis Pitts and Carolyn McAllister from Durham. There was one of the surviving victims was a man by the name of Paul Bermazon, who was a leader in the organization. It was known as the Workers' Viewpoint Organization and changed its name to the Communist Workers' Party about that time. And Paul came in a wheelchair, and Paul testified about his background, the fact that he was the I'm not sure whether it was his parents or his grandparents were survivors of the Holocaust. And he talked about not only that, but he talked about the planning of the march, and he talked about, of course, how he was shot, how his wife Sally was shot, and how some of the other folks, like Sandy Smith, was murdered right there in front of them. We then called as an adverse witness one of the main Nazis. He was about a 6'5", 250, 300-pound Nazi who was representing himself, was in a three-piece suit with sneakers on, and on his lapel he had five white skulls. And so this was a Friday, and I was examining him, and I understood the significance of those skulls on his lapel. And my examination consisted of bringing out some of the things that he was most proud of, like a song that was entitled Kill a Commie for Christ. He had come to a court proceeding earlier with a T-shirt, Eat Lead, You Lousy Red. So there was a whole litany of racist and anti-communist things that I had him admit on the stand. And it was the tension was very, very high in the courtroom this Friday afternoon. And at a break, Paul Bermazon said to me, I think you got him. I think I think he's about to come down off the stand and attack you. And I said half humorously, "Well, you know, I'm committed to this trial, but I'm not sure I'm committed to getting attacked by a Nazi." But we went back into the courtroom, and I realized. At that break, by the way, you know how it is sometimes when the tension is so great that the only release is by laughter, and I had built up the tension and the drama of this cross examination, and I forget exactly what the question and answer was, but it was the jury very inappropriately laughed at it, and that was a bit deflating to me, and that's when I called the recess. But looking back on it, I understand the psychological reasons for that. But we went back into the courtroom, and I confronted him on the five skulls on his lapel. And he didn't, like he had for everything else, directly admit those skulls were the five heroes that were killed in Greensboro in 1979, but it was clear that that's what they were, and that was quite a dramatic day or two among many dramatic days that went on in the courtroom during the 10-week trial.
Paul Bermanzon's a doctor. He's still active. My wife Debbie and I went to a storefront political organization in Kingston, New York, 3 weeks ago, where he and his wife Sally gave a presentation on the Greensboro Massacre. And Sally had written a book about it. He's no longer in a wheelchair, but he is severely disabled. One arm just doesn't work, and he has to limp. But he went out to New York and is working and proudly still active in spreading the word about how you fight Nazis and Ku Klux Klanners. And I went over to him, and I introduced myself, and I said I was a friend of yours, Flint. And his face lit up, and so did Sally's. They were so happy to hear from me about you. It was really a high point of the summer. Anyway, I wanted to get back to the struggle, because it was intense, and it was waged after the massacre by the widows, families, the survivors, many political and religious and community organizations, people's lawyers, paralegals, that resulted in the victory. And I wanted to ask you about those 6 years of struggle that finally got a victory on the right side.
Yes, parenthetically, yes, Paul Bermanzon and Sally Bermanzon were certainly, and it's great that they're continued to be in the struggle. And you mentioned the victims who survived and the widows. Many of those folks, like Marty Nathan, she continues to be active in educating around Greensboro and other issues. Nelson Johnson, who was a CWP leader, African-American man who became a minister down in Greensboro, has had an activist church and been an activist minister there for decades. He was a main witness for us. He miraculously survived the assault, but he was there at the time. And Sidney Waller, Dale Sampson, wife of one of the other murdered that day. Unfortunately, she passed away, but she was a major person in continuing to fight for the history, the narrative, the people's narrative of what happened at Greensboro for decades as well. And so those folks all came together, along with the organization itself, rather than to be defeated by this bloody attack, to fight back. And they fought back by starting the Greensboro Justice Fund. And on the first anniversary in 1980, the lawsuit was filed. As I said, I wasn't involved in the initial filing of it, but I was enlisted to work on it within a couple of years. It was kind of on the back burner while these criminal cases were going ahead, but it got its life back again in 1983 and 1982 and 1983. And by that time, the Greensboro Justice Fund had a lot of support from churches, from activists, from organizations during the trial and in the run-up to the trial. We had a tremendous team of young lawyers, law students, paralegals, an activist, journalist, who all came together, and we had basically a collective, a work collective. Many of us lived together in a house in Winston-Salem during the trial, and a great deal of political work and a great deal of educating and fundraising was done in connection with the case, because all of the, of course, all of us were doing it for free, basically. Nobody was getting paid for it, and we were doing it because we believed in the righteousness of the cause, and we formed bonds in fighting that struggle, a legal struggle and political struggle that lasts to this day amongst all of us.
Yeah, I remember at that time I was working in South Jamaica for doing legal services work, and we had just organized a union. It was part of District 65 of the UAW, United Auto Workers Union, and we had organized the lawyers and the legal workers in our office. And when the demonstration was called, we organized a bus and took a busload of people down from New York City to support the Greensboro Justice Fund. I wanted to ask you if you could give us some more details on, because I think it's a lesson that we learned from how to organize against this stuff. What did the Greensboro Justice Fund do practically to rally support?
Well, they were put out various educational brochures, organized people to come to court dates. Education was a major thing. Organizing to come to court, to have demonstrations, that kind of thing. And interesting journalists around the country did a very good job of getting journalists nationally, including the New York Times, interested in it. Working with church groups in the South, the United Church of Christ, other progressive churches coming to the support, all of those things. And of course, in the courtroom, we raised the political issues. It was, you know, you could have approached this narrowly as a wrongful death case, you know, against the Klan and Nazis, but we took on the conspiracy that we were convinced was at bottom of this case. And through the lawsuit, we were able to uncover a lot of additional information that further exposed the depth of the involvement of the official governments, the state, local, and FBI. And that was a focus not only of us in court, but was a focus of what the people who were doing the organizing focused on as well, to educate people, to raise the issues that we were uncovering in court to the general public, and to do it boldly and effectively. And so that was what the Justice Fund was doing, and working quite closely with the legal team, using the information that we were uncovering and using that in their work to educate around the case.
Well, let's bring it up to date, because there certainly are parallels with what's going on now. I'm thinking of the Nazis in Charlottesville several months ago and the murder of the young woman down there. What are your thoughts on the parallels between kind of the resurgence of the fascists and Nazis in the United States now and what was going on back in Greensboro 30 years ago?
Obviously, the first thought I had when I heard about Charlottesville was Greensboro. There were just too many similarities that occurred to me, and questions that came to my mind, having gone through the, as you mentioned, being involved in the 6 years of legal struggle that uncovered what it uncovered. One thing that was similar was back in 1979, there was a resurgence of the Klan and the Nazis at that time. It wasn't incidental that both the Nazis and the Klan were involved and worked together in this conspiracy to attack the anti-Klan demonstrators. They had meetings. They had created a united front. I forget the exact name of what they called it, but there were different Klan sects in North Carolina. They came together along with the Nazis, and in Charlottesville, of course, we saw this under, you know, being encouraged by the white supremacist powers that be under the Trump administration, of this coming, same kind of coming together many, many years later of Nazis and Klans and other white, you know, and other permutations and current manifestations of the same white supremacy that we saw back in the late 70s coming to Greensboro. And, of course, we had anti-racist, anti-fascist demonstrators of all kinds at Charlottesville. And included in that, those groupings not only were church people and activists such as Cornel West, but we saw the Antifa people, which in some ways you could parallel, to, at least to some degree, with the Workers' Viewpoint or Communist Workers' Party people. They were very, very strongly anti-fascist. They were militant, like the Antifa people. They were anti-Klan. They were demonstrating against the Klan. So you could see those similarities as well. And if you, what I was thinking as well as going forward, we don't know exactly who, what, and where, with the terms of the Nazis and the Klan and the white supremacists. You probably could bet a nickel to a dollar here that there's going to be some FBI informants in there. There's going to be some police informants in there. And if you listen to what Cornel West said, Dr. West talked about how they were attempting to peacefully block the Klan and Nazis from going into the park on Saturday, and they were being viciously attacked, and there was no police in sight. They were trying to get arrested, and they couldn't because the police were not in sight. And he said that the Antifa people saved their lives with their militancy, along with Black Lives Matter people. So there are a lot of similarities. I can anticipate, perhaps, that the legal investigations by the feds, particularly by the Sessions Justice Department, will be similar, if not worse, in terms of how they approach the left victims and the left demonstrators versus how they approach the white supremacists than even the Reagan administration was. Because if you remember, shortly after Greensboro, Carter was voted out and Reagan took over. And so most of the legal manifestations in the early to mid-80s by the feds were by Reagan's Justice Department, which were not that much different than Trump's Justice Department. Not quite as outwardly white supremacist as Jeff Sessions, but pretty close. So we need to watch what goes down in Charlottesville very closely, because, again, the blame the victims, prosecute the victims, investigate the victims is something that we're all too familiar with in these cases.
In the article, Flint Taylor, that you wrote for Truth Dig, you talked about the Trump administration and its overt support for white supremacy. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Well, there's so many different manifestations of it. I'm sure your listeners are as aware of them as you and I are, at least some of them. You start with, of course, building the wall. You talk about the Muslim ban. You can talk about how Trump, Charlottesville, his first reaction was to blame both sides and only to reluctantly condemn in any manner the white supremacists when he said something to the effect, well, there's a lot of good people marching there. Of course, I don't know which ones who were carrying those torches on Friday night were the good people. They might as because they couldn't be, I guess it's against the law down there now to wear hoods. They did blood and soil and carried those torches instead. And you see Trump taking the gloves off of the, to the degree that Obama's administration tried to put, at least attempted in some small way to put some brakes on police violence by their investigations and cutting back a little bit on military arms being sent to local police stations. Trump is taking the gloves completely off of the police, encouraging them very much behind the Blue Lives Matter movement. And we also see the ugly head of black identity extremists, a new category very similar to the categories that the FBI was using in the 60s and 70s to attempt to wipe out the black liberation movement and applying it to Black Lives Matter. We see all of that. We see what was happening at Standing Rock. So we see this cooperation, too, between in some locales. I mean, we do see resistance in some of the big cities in terms of the mayors and some of the more progressive prosecutors, but across the South, and we see that heightened cooperation between conservative prosecutors and the feds in looking at the kinds of prosecutions that they're going to do. And, of course, that was the case in, and is the case in Standing Rock as well. So that, off the top of my head, that's some of the things that I think that I'm sure you can add more to it in terms of how the Trump administration and Sessions at Justice and are implementing white supremacy and defending it.
Well, Flynn Taylor, we've come to the end of our allotted time, but we're so grateful for you to come on Law and Disorder. We wish you luck with your current endeavors, and I'm sure we'll be interviewing you again shortly on what they are. You're a guy that's been causing trouble for 40-some years, and we're very proud of you. Thanks so much, Flynn Taylor, for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you, Michael, and you keep up the good work, you and Heidi as well.
Thanks so much. Take it easy.
Take care now.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we're joined today by attorney Ann O'Berry. She's the vice president of the Southern Region of the National Lawyers Guild. While in law school, Ann served as a director of the Women's in Prison Project at Rikers Island in New York City, where she taught incarcerated women how to prevent termination of their parental rights. Ann clerked for federal judges in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, including the famous Judge A. Leon Higginbotham, Jr. of the Court of Appeals. She taught civil rights and South African apartheid law at the University of Pennsylvania, and then she taught race and the law at St. Thomas University Law School in Miami, Florida. In the last 12 years, Anne has served as counsel at a Florida law firm that specializes in class action litigation, particularly with environmental and privacy rights. Anne joins us today to talk more about her work as a people's lawyer.
Anne O'Berry, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
As a relatively new guild member, we've been excited to learn about your history as a lawyer in the South. We wanted to start by asking you about the publication, The Law Only as an Enemy, that you've written. Can you tell us a bit about that and how it's informed your work?
Yes, I co-authored that with Judge Leon Higginbotham, who unfortunately passed away, but he was my mentor. I worked with him on a project regarding race and the law. He was on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit during that time, but he was also teaching at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, along with NYU and Harvard and many other places. And he had a long-term project on race and the law. We were working on his book, and in the process, we have published various chapters out of that book. His original book was In the Matter of Color, which won a lot of awards, and this was a follow-up to that book. And the focus was basically on issues of powerlessness in terms of the law and the legal structure. And so we did a lot of historical research regarding racism and the law back in pre-Civil War Virginia. We focused on Virginia because it was a paradigm for slavery, basically, and the slave laws that were in place. We wrote an article for publication, it was published in the University of North Carolina Law Review, The Law Only as an Enemy. Basically, we analyzed the different treatment in Virginia, in pre-Civil War Virginia, depending on your status. If you were a free white person or a free black person or a slave, depending on your status, you were treated differently by the law. And what we found was, as an overall theme, depending on what the race of the victim was, that would affect what your sentence would be. For example, if a black woman was raped, that was not considered a crime. If a white woman was raped, that was considered a crime and was punishable by death. And also, if your status, if you were a black person and you stole something, you would be put to death. And it was ironic for the slave owner, because if their slaves were put to death, they had to be compensated by the state because they were considered property. So I guess what I would say about that research is that it certainly still impacts what happens today, believe it or not, many, many years later. I found that when I was doing death penalty work, for example, I did research with Professor Michael Radelet at the University of Florida, who's a sociology professor there, and he had been doing research on race and the law and how the race of the victim impacts how you are treated by the criminal justice system. And what we found was we actually went to four counties in Florida, Volusia County, St. John's County, Flagler County, and Putnam County. And what I did was I went through every single criminal case in those four counties for a certain time period. It might have been 5 or 10 years, and looked at what happened to the people that were charged. And what we found all along the way is that if the victim was black, the crime was treated less seriously than if the victim was white. If there were manslaughter, for example, if there were a killing of a child, if the child was black, the case would be treated as manslaughter. If the child was white, it was treated more seriously as a murder case. It went so far up the line as to go all the way up to whether they would seek the death penalty or not. And so I had believed prior to doing that research that what was the most significant factor was the race of the offender. But after doing this research, what we concluded is that that is a very important factor, but also the race of the victim is extremely important. They just simply treat African-American lives as less valuable than white people's lives.
And it's interesting because when I was in law school in Pennsylvania, I worked on a Baldus study going through all death-eligible case files since the time the death penalty was reinstated to look at aggravating and mitigating circumstances. And, of course, we found similar things as you've described.
How did you get involved in death penalty work? And talk to us about what you do there and what you think about it.
Well, I'm not doing it now, but I started out, I was working at a firm in New York, which was a large, prominent Wall Street-type firm. I'd gone there after law school, and the firm was known for its commitment to pro bono work. The name of the firm was Debevoise & Plimpton. And so I was, I guess what they call it, among some people, I was known as the pro bono queen because I did a lot of pro bono work while I was there. And the
That's great.
I was there for about 2.5 years, and the first pro bono case I did was a death penalty case. We were representing Dalton Prejean from Louisiana. By the time I started working on the case, he'd already been through probably one round of direct appeals, post-conviction appeals, and we worked on his case for about 2 years, and unfortunately he was executed in May 1990. During that time that we worked on the case, he was up before the U.S. Supreme Court twice. Once, the first time, his case was up there on the issue of whether you could execute the mentally retarded, because we had evidence showing that he was mentally retarded. And the court ruled back then that it was okay. It was not unconstitutional to execute the retarded. And then separately, his case was held on the issue of whether you could execute juveniles. He was 17 at the time of his offense. And the court held at that time, yes, there's no problem, you can execute juveniles. So, unfortunately, we went through I don't know how many rounds of death warrants, but as I said, in 1990, he was executed. And he was tried by an all-white jury. Dalton was black. The victim was white. The victim was a state trooper. There were not any issues of innocence in the case. It was more whether he should be executed or whether he should be allowed to serve out his life in prison. It was a very compelling case. Dalton was like a child, basically, and let's just say that along the whole entire process of his case was just a travesty from beginning to end. His attorney, his trial attorney, was drunk during the trial. The jury did not know that Dalton was retarded. In fact, they were told he was a smart kid. They didn't know he'd suffered horrendous abuse, that his mother had abandoned him when he was a child. Amazing mitigating circumstances that the jury never heard. I was so moved by that experience that I decided to give up my cushy job in New York and go do death penalty work full-time. So I ended up at the Federal Resource Center. It was a federally funded resource center doing death penalty work in Tallahassee, Florida. And I did that work from 1991 until 1996 when Congress defunded all the resource centers around the country. And then after that, I spent about a year representing women who were seeking executive clemency. It was called the Battered Women's Clemency Project in Florida. And I thought that working on cases where the clients were not going to be executed would be a little bit easier to deal with, but it wasn't, emotionally speaking, just to meet these women who were literally fighting for their lives and defending themselves against horrendous abuse by their spouses, and who ended up, in some cases, doing life without parole. And so we were trying to get them out on clemency, and we were actually successful in getting a number of women out. So I'm not doing death penalty work at this time, but that was probably the most significant legal work that I've done.
Have there been changes in the application of the death penalty? I mean, the word better is not the word I would use, but are we making progress? I know in some other states outside of the South, we're making some progress on abolishing the death penalty. But in Florida, yes. Georgia, Mississippi, any shifts, any Louisiana, any shifts, any changes?
Well, I will say one thing regarding, just going back to Dalton's case, I mean, more recently, the U.S. Supreme Court did rule that it is unconstitutional to execute people who were juveniles at the time of the offense, and unconstitutional to execute people who are mentally retarded. Florida has gotten on board with that in terms of legislation. So there is a process now for determining whether someone is mentally retarded. I see some improvements. I would say that the example of Troy Davis, unfortunately, is an example of how we have not come very far. I've seen both improvements, and I would say primarily in public opinion. We're seeing a shift in public opinion away from the death penalty because people realize, number one, there's a grave risk of executing innocent people. Number two, it's horrendously expensive to have a death penalty, and many states can't afford it. It will bankrupt a county who's trying to defend one death penalty case that's going through the system. So I'm seeing a shift away from the death penalty, and I really believe that in my lifetime, I'm 51, I believe that in my lifetime we will see the end of the death penalty in this country. I hope that's true. On the other hand, the laws, particularly on the federal level, have become much more difficult in terms of trying to persuade a court to hear your case after you've gone through one round of appeals. The procedural bars to bring in claims, even when you have very, very strong claims of actual innocence, they'll literally kick you out of court even if you're innocent, and it's just an amazing system we have where the courts will say, yes, you've got compelling evidence of innocence, but we're not going to hear your case.
It's emotionally trying to handle this kind of case. What got you through this period of time, and what motivated you?
I would say that what got me through was the victories. It was incredibly hard emotionally, and I have to say I admire the people that are still doing the work today, people who've been doing it for 20 years, 30 years. I don't know how they do it because it takes a piece out of you. It really does. It changes you doing this work. When you come to care for your clients, and if they end up being executed, I mean, it's just nothing worse that I can think of. But what got me through was the wins. When we would win, the sense of victory and justice. You feel like if you fight hard enough, maybe you can win. And I'm happy to say that in the cases that I worked on, where I was primarily the attorney responsible for the case, I don't believe that I had a single case that ended up with an execution. And so I poured my heart and soul into it. I would say that my personal life was non-existent, but it didn't matter to me because I was doing something that I believed in so fundamentally. And to be able to go to your client and say, you got to stay and you're going to live another day, and then ultimately for them to get off death row, is just no greater feeling. And so what got me through was the successes and the support of the people that were doing the work. I mean, there was a tremendous camaraderie among the people that were doing this work.
And but you're still doing political work, you're still doing legal work. Can you just talk about some of that?
Sure. Well, a lot of the work I'm doing now is actually, with the Guild. I'm the regional vice president for the Guild. As Heidi mentioned, I'm a relatively new member. I wish I had joined a long time ago, but the work that I'm doing with the Guild is just the most incredible work, and I'm just so happy to be doing it. And as far as, you know, actual lawyer work, presently I'm working with an attorney, Jim Green, who's a prominent civil rights attorney in West Palm Beach, kind of a legend down here, and I'm very fortunate to be working with him. He does a lot of civil rights, constitutional litigation. We represent people with disabilities, so we do a lot of work with under the ADA and also the Fair Housing Act. I also do some volunteer work with El Sol. It's a day laborer center in Jupiter, Florida.
Yeah, we wanted to ask you about that. That sounds really compelling.
It's great. My understanding is there are about 100 day laborer centers around the country, and the way this started was there was a large immigrant population that, for whatever reason, ended up in the Jupiter area, and it used to be that they would stand out on the street looking for day work. Contractors and what other people would come and pick them up and bring them to jobs. And there was a movement to get something more organized and something that would protect the workers and also be helpful for people who were hiring. So we had people in Jupiter who the neighbors were complaining about all these guys standing out in the street. So there was a consensus that they should figure out a system to have a better system for people getting hired for day work. Jill Hansen, who is the immediate past president of El Sol, she and her husband were two of the co-founders of El Sol, Sol Silverman, who is a longtime labor attorney, and so is Jill. She's a longtime labor attorney and actually was very involved with the Guild up in New York. Unfortunately, Sol passed away before El Sol opened, but the center, it provides legal support, cultural support, know your rights training. They feed everyone every day for breakfast and lunch. And it's basically a community center for the immigrant community. I would say primarily people from Central America, some people maybe from Haiti. And so I started volunteering there with Jill. She's the attorney for El Sol. We basically try to help people with whatever legal issues may come up. We see wage theft cases where people go to work for someone and then they don't get paid because perhaps they're undocumented and the employer thinks, well, I don't have to worry about it because they're not going to come forward to complain.
He has to worry about it if O'Berry's on the case, right? What do you do?
That's right. We contact the employer and we say, hey, we have somebody here who worked for you for however many hours on however many days and didn't get paid. And generally when the lawyer steps in, they'll back off. They'll come forward and pay. If they think they can get away with it, they will. But that's part of the beauty of El Sol is the employers come to El Sol and they register at the center and say, I need however many people to do X kind of work, if it's landscaping or construction or housekeeping or whatever it might be. And then the people are sitting at the center waiting to see if jobs come in. It's a good way to keep track of you know, making sure that these people are, you know, everybody signs in, so you know who the employer is, you know who the employee is, and it's, so they're better protected that way.
And we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to end on preparations for the upcoming RNC in Tampa, and I know you've been very active in that. What do you expect to see?
We expect to see probably 10,000 to 15,000 protesters there based on past conventions. We expect to see and we hope to see many, many people coming to offer help doing legal observing. In terms of what we expect to see from law enforcement, well...
Tanks.
we expect to see all kinds of new toys. You know, we're seeing an increased militarization of the police around the country, and we know they've got tanks that you would see out in the field if you're fighting a war. I don't think they're going to have drones, but you don't know because I guess it was a little bit more than their budget would tolerate. But
they wanted drones, didn't they?
Yeah, they wanted drones, and then I guess the Tampa City Council said, well, these are pretty expensive, so maybe we don't need the drones. But they've got a lot of lot of things they're bringing out. I don't know if they're going to have sound cannons, you know, like the long-range acoustical device. They don't tell us what they're going to be using. Let me ask you,
we're just recovering from 2004, right? Wasn't there the FTA, Free Trade of the Americas stuff in Florida?
And there were multi-million dollar judgments against the city of Miami. And you would think that these multi-million dollar judgments would deter cities from doing the same kinds of things over and over again where they're suppressing people's First Amendment rights. But, I mean, we just saw Chicago shell out six-something million dollars in a settlement, and yet we're seeing it again with the NATO protests that just happened. And of course, every time we have these conventions or these large protest situations with special national security events, we see these ordinances. They pass these draconian ordinances where you can't have a string, you can't have a stick, you can't have a bottle, a glass bottle. I mean,
well, at least they're letting us have string that's up to six feet in length now. And guns are allowed.
Yes, in Florida. The Florida legislature passed a law saying that the municipality's gun control laws can't be any more restrictive than the state law on guns. So if the municipality wanted to prohibit guns in Tampa for the RNC, basically they can't do it because of the state law. And the Tampa City Council tried to get some exception to that passed, and basically the governor said no, the legislature said no. So we have this bizarre situation where you can't have a stick or a glass bottle if you're protesting there, but you're welcome to bring your gun.
Yeah.
So, and this is all supposed to be for public safety. It's just ridiculous.
I wanted to take you back to 1986 when you went to NYU Law School. What were your expectations about going to law school? What would you recommend to young people today who are thinking about going to law school?
It's not much fun, but actually NYU was a great law school. It is and was a very progressive law school. And I'm really glad that I went there, so I'm making my little pitch for NYU.
What about going to law school generally in terms of having some effect on social justice? Are you glad you went?
Absolutely. I mean, I actually started out when I was a teenager, I thought I wanted to be a social worker. And then I came around to the idea that you could probably affect more change, maybe, on a broader level as an attorney. And I think that's been true, for me anyway. And I highly recommend law school. It's an amazing experience, and as an attorney, you have an opportunity to really make incredible changes in the system. We try anyway, and I think speaking for the Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights, for example, I mean, those are two organizations that have had a profound effect on social movements in this country and securing rights for Americans.
And we're very, very fortunate to have you among our ranks. You're truly a fine people's lawyer. I look forward to working with you down in Tampa. And want to thank you for all the great work you've done over the years.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.